Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Right, good morning, everybody. I apologise for the room. We're a bit spread out, but hopefully that won't detract from what we're going to say. This session's on experiential learning, and I'd like to introduce Professor Jane Harrington, who's leading this session with me. And also, like all good deans, we've brought some friends along to help us because we don't have to want to do all the work ourselves. So we have Carol Jarvis from University of the West of England, and specially imported two real-life students, which I think is really appropriate for this conference, Jamie and George. So thank you very much for coming. All the way from Bristol, which is great. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll be hearing from them later. And also Professor Nigel Culkin, who's a Professor of Entrepreneurship at Hertfordshire Business School. So, experiential learning. Well, I'm going to start with a quote from somebody you might have heard of called Confucius. I hear and forget, I see and remember, I do and I understand. And also a quote from Thompson, who talks about Aristotle, who also had a take on this. And Thompson says, Aristotle was correct. It's taken years for professional educators to understand that the human mind knows best by doing, not by listening or reading. More context, really. Murray says, there's dark days ahead for business schools. Reports of a decline in applications, competition in the jobs market, means schools are developing more experiential learning courses. So again, big emphasis there on experiential learning. And Clark and White say, a quality university business education programme must include an experiential learning component. So it's quite clear that there's a growing demand for this type of programme, an experiential learning programme. And of course, there are very many different types of these programmes. Now, McCarthy highlights the benefits of experiential learning. Greater interest in the subject material, enhancing intrinsic learning satisfaction, increasing understanding and retention, the desire and ability to be continuous learners, and also improving communication and interpersonal skills, and also problem-solving analytical skills, and also, most importantly, critical thinking skills. So these are important elements in terms of experiential learning. Now, in my own business school, we are increasingly using experiential learning methods of one sort or another, and I'm sure it's the same in your schools too. And finally, in terms of this introduction from me, Hodge, Proudfoot and Holt talk about a dynamic changing world, and the relevance of education is constantly being drawn into question. Experiential learning allows you to demonstrate that you have the skill to learn. And the key thing here is the link to employment. Experiential learning allows the student to make their education more relevant to potential employers. And only earlier on this morning, we had the Wisdom of the Crowd session. And delegates highlighted as a key priority for producing graduates that are ready for the workplace, two important elements. One, work placements, and the other, setting real projects for real business. And both those relate heavily to experiential learning. I'm now going to hand over to Jane to continue with the introduction to our session.
Thanks, Gerry. And I'm not using this mic because I fancy being a night club singer. There's only five lapel mics. So moving on from this, to say, put this in some context of some of the sort of current research. In the 21st Century Leaders publication that came out in June 2004, 14 was a publication based on some research by the Chartered Management Institute, the ABS and the QAA. And I was involved in that piece of research from the ABS side. As many of you all know already about it, what we were doing was bringing business schools, bringing employers, and also bringing the accreditation body together to actually look at the curriculum for the future and to try and understand the contribution that universities play and to help explain that to employers, but also understand from employers' perspectives what they're actually looking for within business schools. And the Chartered Management Institute, as part of that research, conducted a survey with employers, and they were looking at building practice into the curriculum and what that might actually mean. And certainly what they found was that employers want business schools, as it says up there, to produce graduates who have a business-ready mindset. Commonly in the workshops, employers talked about having business-ready students, having students that could walk into the workplace running. But they found that in their survey that 80% of UK employers believe that business graduates have unrealistic expectations and are poorly prepared for the workplace. How true that is or not is something for us to debate, but certainly that's the perception of the employers from their survey. And they argued that there was a lack of practical experience that they felt was critical in that factor. Now, many of them did talk about students and placements. They talked about a model that they understood. There were far fewer who understood some of the more alternative models that are now being presented. And in a way, that fits with what was being said this morning around FE, that actually, you know, degrees are understood. They're understood in the marketplace. Higher apprenticeships, less so. And I think that would also be true of some of the alternative ways of learning by doing. But the key benefits, certainly, that came out from that study and from other studies are perceived to be to develop skills, learning by doing, or learning how to learn, as other people talk about it, to allow students to apply theory in the classroom and reflect on it. And I think it's interesting, we'll see two examples in a minute of how people do that in very different ways. And to obtain a rounder and more realistic understanding of the world of work and working in organisations. And certainly employers felt very strongly, and this was reiterated in all the workshops, that they felt very strongly that if for a student to come into a workshop as a graduate and be successful, they needed to understand what it meant to be in that workplace and understand how the theory that they'd learnt could be applied in a very active way. And I've gone the wrong way, sorry. And there's many examples that we could have pulled out of experiential learning. I would actually still argue, though, that in business school curriculums, we do see examples in pockets, but we don't see very many business schools where it's across the whole of the curriculum and has actually profoundly changed what we're doing. And I think that's some of our challenges. How do we take some of the flagship examples and actually spread them out? And we're going to talk a bit more about that this afternoon. But what I'd like to do is to introduce you, rather than Jerry and I talking, to introduce you to two very specific examples. And one's from my own business school, and it's around team entrepreneurship. And I'm going to pass over to Carol, George and Jamie, who are much better equipped than me to talk about it.
Thanks, Jane. So as Jane said, I'm, and Jerry introduced us earlier, I'm Carol Jarvis. I'm the program lead on the BA Business Team Entrepreneurship. And Jamie and George are two of our team entrepreneurs, as we call them. What I wanted to do was just give you a very, very brief introduction to what we're doing on the program and then hand you over, because I think they can tell you much more about their experience and what it feels like to study in these ways than I can. The BA Business Team Entrepreneurship is a programme that we've taken up and adapted from a methodology originally developed in Finland by Team Academy, or Timi Akatemia, as it's called in Finland. And it, I suppose what's unique about it brings together team-based learning with ideas about learning entrepreneurship. So the team and the entrepreneurship are equally important. It's entirely learner and learning centred. What we've done is we've got a programme by the students learn what they need when they need it. So we would argue that it's academically rigorous, but it's also incredibly relevant. And we do that by trying to bring something of the culture of the workplace into the HE environment. So picking up on something that Jane and Jerry talked about producing employment-ready graduates, our team entrepreneurs have spent 3 years effectively running their own businesses by the time they leave us. And one of the things I think that does as well, as Dan said about this morning, about the struggle of keeping pace with the changes that are going on in the workplace, and that actually because they're out there, they're doing real projects for real clients, hopefully earning a bit of money in the process, then they're actually kind of, in a way, they're bringing that experience back into us and helping us to stay abreast of what's happening in the workplace in a very, very real way. So I said, they spend 3 years running their own businesses. In the first few weeks of joining us, we put them into two team companies, and we choose which companies they go into on the basis of making them as diverse as we can. The companies are owned and run by the team entrepreneurs. They're completely independent of the university. And at the end of 3 years, typically they're wound up, although some of them may choose to pick them up and carry them on. So that's the kind of big unit, and that's a unit that meets regularly. But within that, there are project teams, and the project teams are much more transitory. They can be anything from two members upwards, and they're actually staffed to suit the needs of a particular project or a client. So they might have members from more than one of the team companies. The difference is, before they can take a project on, they have to get it signed off by all the other members of their team company. So there has to be something in it, either learning or very good income generation, hopefully both of them. So the philosophy behind this is that actually, you've heard me talking about team entrepreneurs. They're not students. They're actually entrepreneurs in the making, if you like. So they're learning that. And what we're hoping to do in the university environment, what we think we can do by bringing this alongside academic study, is that we give them a safe space to actually experiment and do things that are new and different. We don't teach them, we coach them. So we run training sessions twice a week, three hours each, where the coaches kind of work with the team. They're led by the team entrepreneurs. They bring their issues. They bring whatever's relevant to them at that moment in time. Use methods like dialogue and humble inquiry to work with that. And they're supplemented by a series of professional workshops where we tackle some key issues around sort of running the business and personal development. The program's got a very particular ethos, which is about working in teams and learning to work in teams. Something I ran my own business before I joined the university, and something I'd say that's very different from when I started in business is the amount of time that people spend working in project teams. And the ability to get on with and pick up and work with a group of people that you might not know very well is hugely important. So we think this notion of actually developing an understanding of working in teams and building the relationships and partnerships that go with that is every bit as important as the kind of hard skills that people learn. We think that, as I said, one of the things that the university environment does is it gives you a safe place to try out new things. So being a trainee, these guys, by the time they will have left us, may have worked on 20, 30, 40 different projects. They can find out what they're really good at, what really lights their fire, gives them some passion, makes them want to go on and spend their, you know, their careers working on that. The cost, you know, learning from those failures. So all of that stuff that normally when you go out and you set up your own business, many entrepreneurs expect to fail several times before they actually get going. What we're hoping is we're giving them a head start on that as well. And I was a bit shocked by the session at the very beginning of the day, where I think it was only 9% of people thought that internationalisation was really important. I think if you'd asked my team, they would have come out with something very much higher than that. And I think the lads will be telling you in a minute about a session or a couple of visits that they've made and the way that they're working internationally. So what does this mean for the staff? Talked a bit about the programme. I think the biggest challenge for most of us is moving towards leading through inquiry and not instructing. That can be really tough, particularly when you think you know the answers, but actually taking the opportunity away from somebody to figure that out from themselves might be helpful, but it's probably not very useful to them in the long term. So for me, I think personally, the biggest challenge is being useful but not helpful, and you know, holding back, actually really following through on this idea that they are responsible for their own learning. Coaches act as role models. We try and give constructive challenge and feedback. I've talked a bit about the environment, and I suggest the other role, which is not always very comfortable, is we're taking people through a team building process. It can be pretty stormy and traumatic sometimes. So there's something about mediating and in providing opportunities for the different teams to cross-fertilise. So we've had to learn, if you like, to give up our roles as experts. If we're expert in anything, it's in using these experiential and inquiry-based approaches. It's not in our subject knowledge, although all of us have significant subject knowledge that we bring to it. But that's really is, I think, if we're trying to encourage lifelong learners, then really giving them the responsibility, maybe pointing them in some right directions, but giving them the responsibility for finding out what they need to know when they need to know it, so that they go out, they use it, they apply it, and they remember it, to come back to Jerry's first quote. And that, obviously, that role shifts and progresses during the course of the 3 years. So at the outset, most of our team entrepreneurs join us with limited, if any, experience. So we're providing sometimes some quite strong guidance about direction. But by the time they graduate, we're acting more as consultants, and they are really taking full responsibility. These two are actually in their first couple of months of the second year. They're in our first intake, and probably shall I hand over to you, George?
Yeah, cool. Thanks a lot, Carol. Yeah, so what does team entrepreneurship mean to us as students? Me personally, from a very early age, I felt disengaged with the traditional educational system. However, I always had an entrepreneurial mindset. This meant that I was doing extracurricular activities off my own back, but I was still not engaged with the educational system. Now, I finally feel like I'm in an environment where my aspiration can meet opportunity. Myself and Jamie have set up our market research project, and I feel like I've now got passion when I wake up in the morning. I go in every day happy and looking forward to the day ahead.
Yeah, I'm Jamie, and like George, I never really felt fully engaged with education before I reached university. My mum was a high school head teacher, and I used to absolutely hate the parents' evening, and I did have some tears occasionally. And now one of my highlights of the week is actually ringing her up and just telling her what I'm up to, and she's so proud, and I'm so proud, and I'm just, I'm really feeling my element on the course.
So what have we been up to in the past 18 months? A few of the guys started up a crowdfunding consultancy business called Crowdreach.
Yeah, so Crowdreach, I met a guy in the cafeteria and we were just talking, and he actually had a 3D printing accessory that he wanted to take to market, but we didn't have a clue about any business expertise. So we put him in touch with three lads on the course who actually shaped the whole marketing campaign. They put it on Kickstarter and they got £65,000, which is three times their target rate.
This is a UE-based startup, and I think it's so great how we can both collaborate and create the whole institution a more enterprising zone. We've also got Cash for Space. This was started up by another couple of guys on our course. When they first came to Bristol, they seen, as all of us know, just how unaffordable it is to drive as a student. So from this, they came up with a solution of selling marketing on cars for students to outside businesses.
Yeah, and we've also got the Learning Expedition Company, which is still working on a logo, which is why it couldn't make the cut. But this is basically just, they run workshops and they do consultancy for businesses and other higher education institutes and schools, trying to develop a more entrepreneurial mindset within that organisation to be more entrepreneurial using our methodologies.
And lastly, we've got our project, Unique Access. This started out in January when we seen just how open and honest students were with us. We thought, wow, how much value could we add into a market, gathering this information for outside firms, telling them exactly what students want. We're on top of trends and we're constant with our research.
And then suddenly we embarked on a problem which is nationwide. It's £1 billion. We met up with the Vice-Chancellor a few times and we stumbled across retention at universities. So we combined what we already knew we were great at, which is finding exactly what students want. And we also did a bit of digging and we found that our university actually have licenses for industry-leading predictive analytical software. So combining the two, we've come up with a package which can actually improve the retention rates at the university, and we're starting to introduce it to the University of West of England.
Yeah, we think if we can solve this, it'll be such a great feat. Dropouts don't just affect universities on a financial level, which is huge. They also affect it on a social level. It is such a sad scene to see a student dropping out of university, even off some aspects that could be sorted out so easily. We want to target these students and make sure the university does what it does best and provides the right support and guidance necessary.
So these are just a few pictures of what we've been up to. Like Carol said, there's a big focus on the international links, and you automatically feel part of a family when you meet someone else who's on the course. So we've got Paris in the top left, we've got Madrid bottom left, and we've got Hungary in the bottom right. And all of these have come from links with the courses, meeting other people on the doing the same team entrepreneurship course. And I'm actually going out to Finland next week, actually, and doing a conference with Peter Senge, run by other students on the course in Finland.
You feel like you can go to any country in the world, Europe, anywhere, and as soon as you meet someone on a team academy, you feel as part of a family. You both share the same ethos, they'll be open to you, they'll share your home with you. You are part of this interconnected network, and it does feel great. One of the biggest learnings I think I've taken from the past 18 months on team entrepreneurship is just how to take an idea that's in your head and turn it into a tangible business that gives you revenue, and you can start building upon your dreams.
So yeah, that's a little bit about us. We've got big ambitions for the future. The number one team academy company, the record is €1.2 million revenue by the end of the year. So we're actually hoping to smash that within the first year of it's been ran. We've got Twitter, LinkedIn, and I've just started a blog recently where I'm just documenting how we're doing. Usually do weekly reflections so you can keep up to date and follow us on the journey.
Right, cool. Thanks for your time, guys.
Thank you.
I really should get used to being upstaged by students, but it still hurts when I am. So, and that's before I start, so I'm just going to get my coat. I thought there was, as ever, that's a really interesting way of presenting an opening to experiential learning. I want to look at it from a slightly different perspective, the postgraduate perspective. I'm Nigel Culkin, Professor of Enterprise and Entrepreneurial Development at the University of Hertfordshire. I've also just taken over as President of the Institute of Small Business and Entrepreneurship. Many of our members, we had our conference last week, we had about 375, nearly 400 members, delegates up at Manchester. Many of them, professors, readers in enterprise entrepreneurship within business schools. However, the interesting thing is that up to a couple of months ago, ISB and the ABS shared the same offices on Euston Road. I'm not aware that we ever had any conversations or discussions. So I think there's a very good bit of honesty from Jane with regards to there's pockets of excellence in business schools, but we're not sharing enough about what is good. That's got me reflecting for the start. I think in terms of a postgraduate work, that the way that certainly we at Hertfordshire approach it is that we're much closer to the market of entrepreneurship. So experiential learning for us is a very helpful way of getting our more mature students really immersed in the subject of entrepreneurship and enterprise development, something that they are, certainly all our part-time MBA students, are actually doing when they join us. However, I just wanted to create a couple of contexts, one that's external and an internal one, with regards to what the future may hold for us. And as business schools, we've often been accused of being corporate players. We're interested in corporate examples of turning our students into corporate people working in large organisations. But last week, a couple of colleagues from Aston Business School, one of them, Mark Hart, who I think many people here might be aware of, did an interesting talk on some research that they'd done entitled All Grown Up, The Fate After 15 Years of the Quarter of a Million Firms in the UK Born in 1998. And just to give you a little flavour of that and why I think this is important is that there were, at 0 years of age in 98, there were 250,000 firms born that year, and they created 1 million jobs. 15 years later, 90% were dead, and the jobs that they'd created had shrunk to 400,000. Now that to me is quite a sobering set of numbers. After 15 years, the chance of survival fell from the chance of death fell from 25% at age 2 to less than 10% at year 15. So it just, for me, and I hope so you in the audience, to me it says those first few years, the few years that team entrepreneurship is concentrating on, those first 5 years are so incredibly important in terms of creating DNA in founders, in startups, in growth companies that stay with them. So those papers are available now, but I think it is important because in terms of job creation, the highest trajectory, both in terms of growth of jobs and reduction in jobs, took place in those first 5 years. So again, I think that is an incredibly important aspect to sort of take away from this, especially if we are talking about entrepreneurship, the starting of companies, which is what Team Entrepreneurship is doing. So it's great that we've got 3 years support for them, but if they go off, what are we going to do after that? How do we get them back into the alumni? How do we support them in that? Because I think experiential teaching is, you can pick up a book and read about it, but there are many forms of experiential learning. And I think what is happening at the moment is that there's a spread of activity of what experiential learning actually is. And I think what's important for me, I think these slides are all going to be available afterwards, aren't they? So I wasn't too concerned that there was a lot on there, but some colleagues over in Sweden at the Chalmers School of Entrepreneurship come up with a very nice example about what the entry level is to experiential learning and whether those learners actually get to create artifacts, whether they get to create something by themselves or creating with other people or working with the community to develop those artifacts. Again, as we hear from the team entrepreneurship, if we're doing that, then we are delivering a much richer experiential learning. But if we are just falling into the trap of dry business plan writings, interviews, opportunity mapping, project casework, while it sort of gets at one end of experiential learning, it doesn't do justice to what we should actually be doing. As deans and resource managers, that's a problem for you, because the more that we demand of, or the more activity goes on within experiential learning, the greater the complexity of the teaching, and the more likelihood is of greater resources being required. So on my own MBA program, Enterprise and Entrepreneurship, there are something like 9 to 15 of us that engage in a very immersive couple of weekends in January and March. But I do think it's important, because the internal side is that, give it a couple of years, and we're going to be getting George and colleagues who've already done some experiential learning, who've already done some business plan writing. Young Enterprise is giving us, you know, it's been going a number of years now, but it's giving us more and more students who are going to say to us in level one, done this already. What value are you creating for me? And I think we've got to be prepared for that. So those two aspects, for me, are very important. Where we try and pitch our MBA programme is around this venture creation and a sustainable venture creation. And again, we don't dress it up as that. We don't say we're going to create sustainable ventures. But we are talking to individuals who are interested in starting up their own businesses or start heading up a division within a larger organisation. So for us, that's really important. We also take it a stage further that we between the nine of us, we've been working on this for about 4 years. So there's a lot of learning within the group. And I think that's important as well, because there is a danger if, you know, I'm not saying we all sing off the same hymn sheet, but if we do not keep up that immersive activity, which is so rich and so enjoyable and leaves an indelible mark on our students, then again, we aren't giving the best value to those students. So we have a framework that we use, the reflective experiential engagement framework. We, from a philosophical perspective, we actually have an experimental philosopher who's part of the team, who really makes life hard for me, and I'd love to give him away for a couple of sessions. But it really keeps us on our toes. And primarily we do that because we follow the view of Polanyi and Dewey from 1935, that not all knowledge is neutral. And so what we try and do in this is to actually pull that knowledge together between students. We do a lot of stimulation, simulation work. We have them working as individuals, in small groups, in large groups. We throw them about a lot. If my colleague John was here, he'd have you all up on different tables every other 10 minutes. But it's forever trying to recreate the mindsets, recreating where we think we are, chucking the old knowledge out and trying to allow you to think about things in a fresh way. I know we all try and do that. Having a philosopher involved really does help. It also means that we're working with the philosophy department, and I now know where they are, which is always a good thing. We also have an online platform where we encourage and enable our students to deposit their learning. Reflection is fine, but if you have, as we have, weekend, part-time programs, it's very difficult for people to students to find time to reflect. They're going straight from us into a busy workplace. So we've created an online platform that only the students can activate, and we have a sort of this matrix where we reflect, analyse, and think about action against content, process, and learning. So, what did we learn? What did we learn about learning? How can we learn better? And the only thing I can say in the sort of the 10 minutes I've got is that over the past 4 years, we've had something like 133 students, part-time students, through this. And in terms of the reflections, in terms of the marks, in terms of the learning, the students that use this or use this more than other students do end up with better marks and are coming back to us to talk about how they can develop their own businesses after. Just one quick example in terms of the what we do from an entrepreneurship perspective. We use psychodrama, and we use that in a way that at the end of the first session or the end of the first weekend session, we get all of our students to identify somebody in society other than an entrepreneur, to go and interview that individual and ask them to talk them through the last 10, 15 years of their work life. Everybody brings that back. We then create new groups. And in 2012, we were very lucky that we won the National Enterprise Educator Award with Team Venture. So we use a program to actually create those new groups. Students then share those stories. And from those stories about how individuals... So I think it was George who said his mother was a deputy head teacher, interviewing a deputy head teacher about the way that their life and their work has changed over the last 10 years is a fascinating and rich story and a rich journey. We then get them to agree on one of those stories, and they then have to act out a metaphor to the audience and to a wider audience about what that meant to us. We have little prizes. We also have a masterclass with a director who comes along to try and reduce the risk and the fear that some people have of acting. But if we think that most of entrepreneurial activity is acting, trying to get somebody to do something that you want, we find it a very rich experience. I don't have enough time to do too much more, but I just wanted to share with you some of the reflections, or some of the quotes from the reflections that we've had in the... that must be my time up. And we were talking... The team entrepreneur team talked about creating greater interest in the course. And what we've got here are just some examples of how the students, and they're numbered, I think they're numbered up to 82, although we've only got six, I promise, how they've felt after the experience. And student one, I feel that if we've not been in mixed groups, it's likely we've fallen into our known roles to complete the task. We do that too often, I think, as academics. We allow the students to go into their groups, and we don't tackle that. When you do tackle it, it is uncomfy, but the learning for the students is pretty good. People who learnt about themselves, student 12, I thought I had no entrepreneurial experience, but after this immersive period, they recognised much better in themselves what they were and what they were not. This is my favourite one, student 25. I don't feel that this module taught me anything new. However, I recognise it made me think more deeply about my personality, skills. I also believe the module was helpful in bringing together several themes from across the course and using them to solve real-life business problems. And she ran a company. That person ran a company. You must remember to not bring in gender. The last three, the module has been enlightening to me. My mindset's changed. 61... Since reflecting on the module as a whole, this combination of elements has called a real change in my thought process. That person has come back 2 years later to talk to us about their new venture that they're starting and how we might be able to help them. Because the other thing to say, just as I finish, is that we've designed this MBA module that we can use many of the components on our business startup program for undergraduates as part of our extracurricular activity. And again, we look at that about sharing amongst different parts of the community. So I'll finish on that and hand over to Jane, I hope, I think, or is it Q&A? Questions and discussion.
Thank you, Nigel. That's really the end of what we wanted, because we wanted to have enough time for questions, answers and any discussion. So I'd like to just pass over to the floor and ask if you've got any questions of any of us, really, and happy to take anything that you want to talk about.
First of all, can I just say thanks very much. It was really interesting, and particularly to George and Jamie, you've taught us all a lot there about how to present and also how to inspire an audience with stories. And I think that what came across for me was a real engagement by students in their learning. And my own background is actually from clinical legal education. Colleagues might be interested that there's a rich literature in medical fields and in legal fields about the notion of clinical and experiential learning that I think can fit quite comfortably with initiatives that we're trying to now develop in the business field, and I think that there's an awful lot of overlap and significant connections between these different disciplines. And, of course, there's a large set of adult learning theory that supports the notion that people learn better when they learn by doing. What probably is missing a bit is empirical data to support the better performance of students that graduate through a more experiential type of process. And what I would encourage people to do as they are developing new experiential modules is to use the data that they've got. So as a cohort goes through, we've got a great set of data there that we can use for comparative purposes to analyse the impact that experiential learning can have. Sort of coming around to a question, I just want to say that background just to say how enthused I am by the notion of experiential learning in a business context. My question is this: in medical and in legal traditions, there tends to be an ethical component to experiential and clinical learning. So it would be healing, or it would be serving social justice. And I wonder to what extent there is or should be an ethical component behind a business clinical type of approach. Or is it okay if we just say making profit and having a successful company is itself enough of a benefit that we don't need to look for any broader societal benefits coming out of the project?
I'll pass over to Carol and Jamie and George on this, but just might be worth just on your last question. I don't think we probably all got different views about that, but certainly we had Stephen Fear, an entrepreneur, come and talk to us recently, and actually talking about there's nothing wrong with making money, that actually does provide societal benefit. And I think there's something about how we make money that might be the question, but making money in itself, we train accountants, I think they have a role to do that. So, but I think it's interesting to hear from Carol, because there's certainly, in terms of the experiential learning and evidence, there is some from Finland and some of the experiences. And it'd be interesting to see your take on ethics and yours as well, Nigel. So over to you.
And if it doesn't, I can probably talk loud enough anyway. I think, to take the first point, in Finland they've been running this approach for about 20 years now, and they are beginning to get some quite good data. So in terms of employability, for example, 91% of the graduates of these programs are in graduate level employment within six months of leaving, which is significantly higher than the Finnish average. And typically, those that go into employment rather than starting their own business go into organisations who are sort of more blue chip, and they tend to go in at a slightly higher level than somebody with the equivalent degree classification who's come from a traditional business background. Within 2 years, it's just under half of them are actually running their own business, and I think that compares with something like 4 or 5% in Finland as a whole. So again, there's beginning to be some quite sort of significant information around that. I think the ethics question's really important, and I do a lot of executive education work in the NHS, and I think you're absolutely right. Some of these problem posing approaches have been quite well used in clinical areas for a long time. And I think that's, as soon as you start doing that, you have to introduce an element of ethics. Our programme, we have what we call leading thoughts. I agree with Jane that there is nothing wrong with earning money, but money in itself isn't a purpose. So I think if I went back to our slides, I mean, one of the things that's part of our mission is around sharing the learning. So a project is seen to be valuable if it brings new learning, and almost the income is subsidiary to that. So some projects are more socially kind of orientated. We've got one lad, for example, who's looking at developing an app to encourage younger males in particular through gaming to donate to charity. And that's not a money-making venture. That's, you know, that's something that would be more sort of in the social sphere. We also have all of our modules have an ethical element to them, and it's one of the things that we take into consideration. Our values include things like being sincerely happy when other people succeed. So I think perhaps the Finnish culture is a little bit more collaborative than the UK, and as I mentioned, we do have some quite strong competition between teams, but we also encourage them to collaborate and to work together and I guess a measure of success is how we add value to the customers, whoever that customer would be. So Jamie and George, for example, are in different team companies, in some senses. Would you have collaborated when you first started?
Yeah, I think we would have, to be honest.
No, I wouldn't. Not with him.
But, I mean, I don't know. Do you see the ethics in the programme?
Yeah.
I think so. Everyone on the programme has got quite a strong corporate sense of social responsibility. There's been one project that's ongoing at the minute, the Helpful Water Company, and it's all about giving money back through purchasing water through these bottles that aren't plastic. Based on a new report that's coming out that plastic is harmful to your health. I mean, we try to have quite a lot of the academic stuff as well, the underpinning, that delves into ethics and it gets you feeling quite philosophical about the work that you're actually doing on projects. So I think we are encouraged to think about it, and it is in our ethos a lot.
I think the kind of environment that we're running the business as well, there's such a kind of family feel to it, and everyone's so friendly, even internationally, that it kind of, there's no evidence for this at all, but you kind of feel that people would be a lot more ethical in the way they run business just because of how everyone else is working and the kind of general feel, really.
I think ethics to me is a difficult one. People bring in their own ethics into a classroom. And I think we can. We have to be ethical as learners. It was why I said that 90% of startups in 1998 are now dead and buried, and that's an ethical duty that we have about asking young people to go down a road of entrepreneurship. So I think I don't tend to talk about social enterprise. I tend to talk about good and bad enterprise and give examples. But there is a takeaway that individuals will have based on where they come into it. And I think it's good that there's an environment that's been created on the UE program. And we try to do it, but in a slightly different way. So we will cover gender and entrepreneurship. We know that there is an issue with female entrepreneurship and there's not as much as there should be. But we try not to take a sociological perspective of that. We try to present it in a gender-neutral way and help students take out from it what they will. But I think people do bring in their own ethics to an area, to an institution over a period of time. We can do a lot to do that. I don't think we can do everything.
Yeah, I think we've got time for one more question. Just over there. And just while the mic's going over to you, Just to say, we also have a large law department, and they actually do now work with Carol's team, and I think that actually brings an interesting dimension as well to some of the things you raised.
Hi, Alex Hiller from Nottingham Trent. So thanks to everyone. Again, thanks particularly to George and Jamie. Really loved your enthusiasm for what you're doing. I just wanted to pick up on a couple of points that were talked about. And a question for the UE team, first of all. You talked about how this has sort of changed your attitudes to learning. And you were talking earlier as well about kind of seeing pockets of experiential learning. So how is what you're doing kind of integrated, if at all, into your curriculum? Or is it something that you do in addition to the classes that you're already running? Or is it something that you credit? And how does that work within the curriculum? And I suppose there's a wider question for the two deans, which is how do you and your schools try and make sure that these things aren't just pockets and that you are integrating this experiential dimension into the full curriculum for all students?
I'll pass over to Jamie and George, but just to say one of the things, I mean, certainly team entrepreneurship was quite an experiment for us, and one of the things that Carol's looking at is how do you actually do exactly what you're saying, spread not necessarily the programme in its entirety, but actually the ethos of it and actually some of the messages that we've learnt from it.
Yeah, so as part of the academic kind of underpinning, so we've got to do kind of book reviews. So we'll go and do a book review, and then we'll read a book, and then we'll review it and see how we've applied that theory, how it compares with other theories we've read, and whether we agree, disagree. So we've got to read probably around 10 books a year, I'd say. Around 10 books a year with complex different theories in them, and we've also got to do presentations on what we've learned, sharing it.
We also as well have training sessions twice a week. These are 2 3-hour sessions with everyone in the team company, so around 15 members, and we all share what we've learned throughout the week. And I think that's one of the best ways to collaborate, and you take learning from other people and you take their strong characteristics on board, and you then become a product of everyone else's best qualities in your team company.
So yeah, everything is integrated into actually running the business and improving how you run the business, and you get assessed on that. So,
I'd just like to add, in terms of Hertfordshire Business School, at the moment we have pockets of experiential learning, but it's not across the whole curriculum. And of course we recognise the benefits of moving this way, but we've also got to be realistic as resource managers about the resources required and the organisation that's required compared to a traditional module. And there's a lot more that has to be done here. But as I pointed out at the start, there are more and more modules developing in this area, and we need to start embracing. And some of the speakers yesterday also referred to this as well, the speakers that we had here yesterday. And we're moving that way, but we need to recognise the resource requirements that this brings, because they can be quite heavy.
Our experience of running this is, I would say, it's a programme, not a module. So it's everything. They don't have any talk classes in that sense. And our experience, and Carol will correct me if I'm wrong, is that the actual staffing resource isn't any higher, but the requirement for facilities and office, because they operate as if it's an office space, so they need that space for 24/7, and that's where the challenge for us comes on how you'd grow that. I don't know if you'd add to that.
So staffing-wise, there is, I think, a perception within the institution, amongst some colleagues, that we're better resourced. But in fact, we get the same workload as we use the same amount of work time as other programmes. I think the difference is, because the nature of the programme, we actually have much higher contact time with students, because we spend less of our time away from them doing, you know, writing lectures and things like that, because it's much more the preparation tends to be done in conjunction with our team entrepreneurs. So actually, in that respect, I think it's a very, from a coach point of view, it's actually very rewarding, because you actually get to spend much more of your teaching time with students rather than kind of locked away in your office preparing materials or dealing, you know, we still have to deal with exam boards and things like that, but it feels pretty good. And the space, I think maybe we do use slightly more. The flip side of that is I think we have some of the highest space utilisation in the university because typically our team entrepreneurs are in that space from 9 till 5, Monday to Friday. And in fact, it's probably fairer to say 10 till 8 might be might be a bit more realistic than 9 till 5. But
I'm afraid we need to finish now. So I'd just like to say, on behalf of Jane and I, thank you all for coming, and a particular thanks to Nigel, Jamie, George and Carol for supporting us. So thank you very much.